At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street and the White House met to talk banking today. We will talk about why they had to meet at all. Google is talking about its own cell phone. And our team in Copenhagen is talking about the bottom line. Who is going to pay to take care of climate change? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America. 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. And by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here, everybody. It is Monday, the 14th of December today. We knew last week that President Obama was going to sit down with CEOs of some of the big Wall Street banks today. We even knew what his message was going to be coming out of it, that banks need to lend more to small businesses to get the economy going again. What we and a whole lot of other people are still wondering is why so much of what happens in this economy is still tied up with Wall Street banks after all we've been through. And when that might change. Douglas Elliott is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Doug, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
First of all, about the president's meeting with the bankers today, he came out and he said, they had a candid chat, which is usually Diplo speak for fairly rough words being said, fairly straightforward words. Do you have any sense that the banks are chastened at all by the events of the last 18 months?
Of course the banks are chastened by the last 18 months. They don't want to do it again. They do actually favor a substantial amount of regulatory reform. They're just doing everything they can to shape it so that it allows them to be as profitable as possible.
You know, banking in this country used to be kind of boring, right? I mean, as long as we're talking about the risk-reward curve. Banks took in money, they lent out money, it was fairly straightforward. And there were some calls a year ago for us to get back to plain old boring banking. Boring but safe. Is that ever going to happen again?
It's not going to happen again. We're in a much more complex world now. We're in a globalized world, and we're in a world with a lot better information systems. And part of what that means, for example, the information systems, is markets allow you to find the best match between whoever wants to borrow the money and whoever has the money to lend. So as we've moved more towards markets and the complexity that comes with a global world, it's reached the point where that good old-fashioned bank just wouldn't be able to provide the services that many of our companies and even individuals need.
You know, you mentioned regulation a moment ago, and the president talked about this in his remarks this morning, that, you know, the bankers say, on the one hand, they are interested in more regulation, but their lobbyists on Capitol Hill are doing everything they can to make sure that the new financial regulations that come out of Congress are friendlier to the banking industry. Does that match for you?
Absolutely. Look, this is an important sector of the economy. It's a very complex thing to regulate. Now, I do worry that we have too many of the big lobbying guns on the side of the financial institutions. But on the other hand, you have tremendous anger against them right now.
Is that anger justified, do you think? I mean, the anger that the American public still has, I believe, against the banking industry, is that justified?
There is tremendous anger in the public mind against the bankers, there's no question. And of course, to some extent, it's justified. Bankers were a big part of what blew up the world. And there's plenty of reason to be angry.
Let me ask you a question about the psyche, right? Because for the past, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 years, the American investor has been incredibly optimistic. We have bought shares in a lot of companies. We have maximized the potential of our houses, all those things. Were the banks doing the same thing?
Yes, it was individuals. It was people on Wall Street. I think the reason this blew up so badly is we had 25 pretty good years from 1982 to about now. You could hardly avoid making money if you took risk.
On the theory that we've cured the optimism and the laxity with these new regulations, how long do you think it's going to be before people aren't leery of banks anymore?
I think in a few years, people won't worry too much about banks. And when you get out 10, 15, 20 years, I think you're going to find another blow up because everybody gets too optimistic again.
Douglas Elliott, fellow at the Brookings Institution. Doug, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
We'll get to our coverage of the UN Climate Conference in just a little bit. But there was merger news today that plays directly into the debate over what to do about global warming. The country's largest oil company made a big bet on natural gas today. ExxonMobil is going to spend $41 billion for XTO Energy. It's a big player in the ever-expanding market for natural gas. This is one of the biggest corporate takeovers of the year. And Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, it is also a sign of a shift away from oil and coal.
This is Exxon's biggest corporate deal since it merged with Mobil in 1999. XTO owns natural gas fields all over the United States. They tap what's known as unconventional gas reserves, including gas in beds of shale rock. Raoul LeBlanc at PFC Energy says that business is booming in the U.S. right now.
The companies that have been pursuing unconventional gas have been posting growth rates that make all the supermajors green with envy.
Supermajors like Exxon, whose oil reserves and production growth have been shrinking. XTO, on the other hand, boosted production 23% last quarter. New technology now allows companies to tap into vast U.S. natural gas reserves that were once inaccessible. Energy expert Philip Verlager says Exxon sees huge potential for natural gas here, especially since it burns cleaner than other fossil fuels.
Exxon clearly sees an advantage for natural gas over oil and coal, given the current environment to limit emissions. Whether we pass a bill through Congress or whether EPA limits emissions, it is going to be more expensive to burn other fossil fuels, and this will give Exxon an advantage.
Verlager says Exxon also sees one other advantage in this deal.
Owning resources in the United States is a much safer bet.
Compared to, say, Iraq, where this past weekend Exxon declined to bid in the latest auction of Iraqi oil licenses. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Well, the inevitable began to happen this weekend. Tiger Woods' sponsors are dropping out. Accenture has officially cut its ties. A couple of others have pulled out entirely or put their marketing campaigns on hold. But Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that most of them are holding on until he comes back.
Tiger Woods brings in about $90 million a year in sponsorship fees, or at least he did. Some companies, like Accenture and Gatorade, have dropped him. Others, like Gillette and AT&T, are re-evaluating. But media economist Jack Myers thinks most will stick with him.
There's huge financial implications, and marketers are not going to be quick to drop their support of him altogether.
But there might be some collateral damage. Tiger Woods has his image on so many products that when he gets mocked, so do they. Like this Nike ad.
I'm Tiger Woods.
I'm Tiger Woods.
Hi, I'm Tiger's mistress. No,
Marissa Gluck is with marketing firm Radar Research. She says for more conservative brands like Accenture, jokes like this are rough. But for other brands, it's not such a problem.
I think for Nike, being mentioned on Craig Ferguson, being part of the popular culture, keeps them top of mind. And it, in a way, you know, makes them maybe even a little hipper because they're part of the joke.
Gluck says as long as Tiger gets golfing again and wins tournaments, his brand will recover. She points out basketball star Kobe Bryant and supermodel Kate Moss lost sponsorship deals over scandals, but their images recovered. And Gluck says marketers have invested heavily in Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods is his own cottage industry. He's too big to fail.
Woods is worth an estimated $1 billion, more than any other sports figure in history. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Forget the bank bailout. Dubai got a lifeline today. That helped bring Wall Street to keep its head above water. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The credit crisis has made student loans harder to get, and they have gotten harder to pay back, too, for graduates of for-profit schools in particular. The Department of Education released some new figures today on student loan default rates. Turns out students at for-profit colleges default at much higher rates than those at nonprofit schools do. And if those default rates get too high, schools can be shut out of federal education and loan grant programs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
About 21% of students at for-profit schools who started repaying their loans in fiscal 2007 defaulted. That compares with just under 10% for public four-year schools. Mark Kantrowitz came up with those figures after crunching today's numbers. He's publisher of FinAid.org.
Today's figures are just preliminary for the last 3 years to give an early warning to these schools.
A lot of the for-profit schools offer training in a trade, beauty schools, for example. They welcome low-income students. Harris Miller heads the school's trade group, the Career College Association. He says it's no surprise their students default more.
Because they don't have a rich mommy and daddy to back them up.
Miller says for-profit schools get 70% of their revenue from grants and loans, so it would be a big deal for them if they were barred from federal aid programs. Schools will be disqualified if they have a default rate of 30% for each of 3 years or 40% for 1 year. Dan Madzelin administers post-secondary education programs at the Education Department. He says the department released today's numbers to give schools an idea of where they stand.
There is no reason to panic. But schools ought to be aware of what looks like might lie ahead for them.
So schools will have a chance to shape up, especially if being disqualified from federal loans and grants would put them out of business. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The delicate balance that is the Copenhagen Climate Conference teetered on the edge for a couple of hours today. A group of developing economies threatened to walk out unless rich countries agreed to a binding treaty by the time the summit wraps up. That'd be Friday. Turns out it was more negotiating tactic than actual threat, but it did work. Rich countries did wind up saying they are willing to discuss binding commitments on greenhouse gas cuts. None of this negotiating happens in an economic vacuum, which is why we've got Sam Eaton and Stephen Beard in Copenhagen covering the global economics of global warming. And here is Sam on what might turn out to be the key question on climate change. Where is the money going to come from?
Nobody!
One Africa!
One Africa!
Every day, activists stage dozens of demonstrations inside the conference center, a stone's throw away from the closed-door meetings. And their demands reflect one of the biggest stumbling blocks to an accord. Basically, it's a question of who's responsible for heating up the planet and who pays to stop it.
Climate justice now! Climate justice now!
This particular demonstration is led by a group of African activists. They say poor nations around the world are already suffering from the effects of climate change. More frequent droughts, rising sea levels, disease. They blame those problems on the rich world and the greenhouse gases it spews into the atmosphere. They're demanding hundreds of billions of dollars a year in compensation. Mala Reddy is an Indian environmentalist. I bumped into him as he held a giant sign, hoping to catch the attention of passing delegates.
This is a check. It's a model of a check that we expect the rich countries will give to the poorer countries and rich people to the poorer people, yeah, as an aid.
But the industrialized world is still deep in recession, and sending billions of dollars overseas could be politically impossible. That is, unless leaders begin to frame the problems these poor nations face as a business opportunity instead of a cost. Poor countries will need help coping with natural disasters caused by climate change. But in the longer term, helping these countries become non-polluting can be financed by business investment if the agreement encourages a business solution. Artur Runge-Metzer is the European Commission's chief negotiator.
We are not talking about throwing money into a dark hole or so. We are talking about investment. You invest in infrastructure. You invest in new technologies.
Investments, he says, that could have huge payoffs.
Smart grids, smart buildings, smart transportation systems, and general process efficiency.
That's why hundreds of businesses are here pitching their wares alongside the environmental activists. Trade groups are also roaming the halls. Nadine Kennedy is with the U.S. International Business Council, which represents multinationals ranging from Nike to Procter & Gamble.
Climate change and the broader energy issues are touching on every aspect of commercial activity and transaction, and the opportunities are there.
Kennedy says her group wants tough limits on carbon emissions because it would create an instant global market for many of the businesses she represents, the result being billions of dollars of private capital flowing from rich nations to poor. But that won't happen if countries don't use strong enough measures to require the use of these new technologies. Jason Anderson is with the global environmental group WWF.
Essentially, it would mean that public capital would have to take over because you haven't stimulated the private market.
And the longer we wait to agree on a binding deal and set business in motion, the bigger the public tab becomes. At a recent press conference in Copenhagen, the UN head of negotiations, Ivo de Boer, said by 2020, the amount of money industrialized nations would have to pay poor ones to deal with climate change would be around $300 billion a year. And he said how much of that money would come from business is impossible to answer.
All I can guarantee is that at the end of the day, it all comes out of your pocket, just by different routes.
In other words, we can raise taxes or we can pay more for the energy we use now. But in the end, that's the point, figuring out what our pollution really costs. In Copenhagen, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
All of our special coverage of global warming from Copenhagen and from before is on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the Red Cross at a crossroads.
The lack of manpower leads to fatigue. Fatigue leads to mistakes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 29 points today, 0.2%, closed at 10,501. The NASDAQ rose 21 points, nearly 1%, finished at 22.12. The S&P 500 edged up 7 points, 0.7%, finished at 11.14. Investors cheered the news that oil giant Exxon is going to buy XTO, the natural gas company we told you about. Well, some investors cheered anyway. XTO shares jumped more than 15%. The well went dry for Exxon. Its shares fell more than 4%. The markets didn't get much of a boost from that big banker summit at the White House. U.S. Bancorp promised to give all rejected loans, quote, a second look, but its shares barely budged. Same story for Bank of America. Its shares closed flat even after CEO Ken Lewis pledged to lend $5 billion more to small businesses next year. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America. 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. And is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs such as Marketplace Money, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on the use of DNA evidence to solve rape cases. The Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for the month of November. And in Beverly Hills, nominations for the annual Golden Globe Awards are announced. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. For most of us, if we want to search the internet, we go to Google. You want to buy a cell phone? Well, Google is probably not the company of choice, but it's making noises like it wants to be. The company has had cell phone software out there for a while now. Android, it's called, and it can be used with a number of different handsets from a number of different manufacturers. But the word is out that Google may also be getting into the business of producing its own actual phone. Peter Rojas co-founded the technology website Engadget. He's got a new site now. It's called GDGT.com. Peter, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
I thought, and maybe it's just me, I thought there already was sort of a Google phone out there. I mean, they've got this software, don't they, on a bunch of other handsets?
Yeah, about a year ago or so, actually, the first what people call the Google phone came out running Android, and that was a phone from HTC called the G1. And Google actually worked very closely with HTC on the software and the hardware on this phone, though Google wasn't selling it themselves, except to a small number of software developers. This is a phone that most people got from here in the U.S. from T-Mobile.
Right. And the thing that's supposedly new now is they're developing some kind of Google-only phone, yes?
Well, that's the speculation that they're actually, I mean, the phone that people have been seeing photos of on the internet, that's actually still built by HTC. They're still the people actually making the phone. But the speculation is that Google is going to sell this under their own brand and try to actually sell it directly to consumers, which would be something of a shift from what they've done earlier.
Why so?
Well, because Google previously has been sort of more content to sit back and let other companies sell and make and market the phones, right? And this would be the first time that Google would be ostensibly the brand marketing and selling the phone itself. They wouldn't be partnering with someone on it.
And it's not going to be tied to a specific carrier, right? So it would be, in the parlance, it would be unlocked so you could go to any carrier you want and get service from them?
Well, from what we've been hearing, that they're going to be working with T-Mobile, but yeah, that the phone would be unlocked, which means that if you did buy it, you could conceivably run it on another carrier here in the U.S.
I have to ask you this, though, Peter. Google is, when you get right down to it, an advertising company. They get, you know, 95% of their revenue from those ads on its website. Where does this fit into the business strategy?
Well, Google is trying to get a foothold in the mobile advertising space, which is kind of where all the interest and energy is going right now. And we're seeing smartphones become great platforms for people browsing the web, using applications and things like that. And it's also become a platform for serving advertisements. And that was sort of the original purpose behind Android in the first place was, if people are going to start using the web and interacting with the internet on their phones, Google needs to be there. And their concern is that the iPhone is so successful, especially here in the U.S., that Apple or somebody building for the iPhone might be able to sort of corner the market for mobile advertising. And Google can't let that happen because that's the future of their business.
Care to hazard a guess for me when we might ever see this phone?
Well, I think that we might see something pretty soon. It was a little interesting for Google to give phones to their employees and then expect that no one would talk about it. I think that that was probably deliberate of them to build up a little bit of buzz and interest. I'd be surprised if we didn't have anything conclusive by early next year. I mean, the Consumer Electronics Show is next month in Las Vegas, and that'd be a good time as any for, you know, a new phone to come out, which people get excited about.
Peter Rojas, co-founder of GDGT.com. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
As we talked about in our philanthropy series a couple of weeks ago, the recession hit charities as hard as it hit anybody. The American Red Cross is one of those charities. It's struggling with an overall drop in donations, of course, but the Red Cross is also facing some extra financial challenges. The way it collects and distributes blood has been under federal court supervision for almost 20 years. Financial scandals earlier in this decade have tarnished its reputation somewhat. And lately, workers for the Red Cross have complained about cost-cutting. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Philadelphia's cavernous Wachovia Center is usually home to the Flyers ice hockey team. But a couple weekends ago, it hosted more than 600 blood donors laying prone on gurneys as Red Cross medics in white coats drew blood. Outside, on the rainy streets, drivers of blood mobiles and delivery trucks handed out leaflets to the blood donors, explaining why they're on strike. Carl London, who's worked for the Red Cross for 30 years, says the charity has laid off so many delivery people that those who are left routinely work 12 to 14-hour days, 7 days a week.
The lack of manpower leads to fatigue. Fatigue leads to mistakes. Mistakes lead to the risk of the blood products once they are received in the hospital, which put the public at risk.
Red Cross workers say the long hours mean blood could be improperly screened for disease or mislabeled or contaminated through careless transport or storage. In October, a union-sponsored study found chronic understaffing, high turnover, and lack of training for all levels of the Red Cross's 33,000 employees. Christine Holschlag, a union leader in Hartford, Connecticut, is a Red Cross phlebotomist, or blood taker. In her 6 years there, she's seen the number of registered nurses cut from 30 to 12.
So you may be at a blood drive in Connecticut, and there may not be a licensed person there. If there's an issue of assessing an eligible donor, the nurse is, you know, supposed to come in and assess to make sure that the product is going to be a good product and that the recipient's receiving something that's safe.
At National Red Cross headquarters in Washington, Gail McGovern is the eighth president in the last 10 years.
I did want to sign up for a challenge, but I really walked into a challenge.
When McGovern took over last year, the Red Cross was $200 million in debt, and the government had assessed millions in fines for mishandled blood. Using her management background from AT&T and Fidelity Investments, McGovern slashed 1,300 jobs, cut raises, benefits, and operating expenses. She won't discuss union complaints, saying they're part of labor negotiations, but she says she's been through downsizing at private companies, and humanitarian organizations are completely different.
People are here because they want to make a difference. They are here because they want to help others. And when the employees look to the left and right of them and they see the cubicles next to them are empty, they experience it in a much more severe way than you would suspect in a for-profit environment.
McGovern's cuts have eliminated three-fourths of the Red Cross's deficit, but it's still been unable to shake government concerns about the safety of its $2 billion-a-year blood operations. The latest FDA-ordered recall of possibly tainted blood products was just over a month ago. The director of the FDA's Office of Compliance, Mary Malarkey, says the Red Cross is still screening and storing blood improperly.
That's something that they're really struggling to get a handle on, and that we are seeing some progress, but unfortunately, I guess I would say that the pace of the progress has been somewhat slow.
McGovern says she understands why the FDA is concerned.
I applaud their zeal in ensuring that the nation's blood supply is safe. We also are monomaniacal when it comes to patient safety. We're seeing a tremendous improvement, particularly over the last 18 months, in our number of recall products, in our problem management areas.
But so far, those improvements have not been enough for FDA regulators to stop the warnings and lift a 17-year-old consent decree that requires close government scrutiny of the Red Cross's blood operations. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A quick observation about banks before we go. As you have probably heard, Citigroup is going to pay back $20 billion in TARP money. An additional $25 billion the bank got back in the dark days of the credit crisis has been converted to company stock. Taxpayers now own 34% of Citi. So consider this. Citi is going to raise the $20 billion it's going to pay back by issuing new stock, which makes the stock that current shareholders have less valuable. Share dilution is the common phrase. That'd be you and me being diluted. Citi shares fell 6% today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 29 points, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, almost 1%. The S&P 500 edged up 7 points. That is 0.7%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And on this program next time, not all those delegates in Copenhagen have expense accounts.
We brought our own soap and our own towel, and we actually packed our own groundnuts from home and our own coffee.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.